I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, we're going to pose a question. Should people convicted of possessing child pornography pay the victims in the pictures? But first, that new jobs bill, it moved forward in the Senate yesterday with the support of five Republicans, including newly elected Massachusetts Senator Scott Brown. One Tea Party activist is already calling him Benedict Brown. But is this a hint of bipartisanship? Naftali Ben-David covers Congress and politics for The Wall Street Journal. And Naftali, start by telling us what exactly is in the bill.
Well, the bill has a few main elements. It's intended to focus very specifically on job creation. So there's a tax break for companies that hire unemployed people. There's an element that allows businesses to write off some equipment upgrades. There's some help for construction bonds issued by state and local governments. And then there's an extension of federal highway transportation projects. And all of that's designed to get people working as soon as possible.
Well, even supporters say that it's modest. Maybe 250,000 private sector jobs will be created. But do we know when and where?
Well, we certainly don't know where. I mean, it's not crafted to favor any particular geographical area. Just about the one thing we can say about it is that there's something of a focus on construction and infrastructure-type jobs. I think a lot of lawmakers believe that that's something that can be done quickly and is a good way to provide employment.
Well, an earlier version of this bill had a lot more jobs involved. It was a much bigger measure, but it also included a lot of corporate tax breaks. More Republicans liked that proposal. More Democrats thought it was pork-laden, so Harry Reid dropped it. But what are Republicans saying now, those that didn't vote on this new version, when Americans so desperately need jobs?
Well, it's interesting. In some ways, they're not saying very much at all. You know, yesterday there was a debate on the Senate floor, but Republicans barely spoke out at all. The Democrats kept on getting up and saying what a great thing it was, and the Republicans chose not to respond by and large. And I think that's because they don't really oppose anything that's in this bill. They're mostly furious at the way it was handled. There was this larger bipartisan measure. A lot of Democrats complained that there were some extraneous things in there designed to get Republican support. So Harry Reid decided to drop all those out and stay with some core job creation measures and prevent any Republicans from offering amendments. So a lot of Republicans are furious at the way he handled it and are voting against it more for that reason than because there's any element in the bill that they oppose.
Well, and Scott Brown did vote for it. He said that he didn't like it, but some jobs are better than none. We know Tea Party activists are angry at him. But on the other hand, this may help their argument that they are independent, not tools of the Republican Party. We just wondered, how do you see his vote? Does it seem to be a loosening of the Washington gridlock?
Well, certainly the Democrats hope so. Harry Reid, after the vote, was talking about this being a new day. I'm not sure that that's totally true. I mean, you know, we have to see. This was one vote. It attracted five Republicans. It's not like it attracted 20 of them or something.
Let's take a second and list them. Susan Collins and Olympia Snowe of Maine, George Voinovich from Ohio, and Christopher Bond of Missouri.
Yeah. Right. And these are people, by and large, who do have a history in the past of occasionally deviating from the party line and joining the Democrats. But it hasn't happened in a while. And I think part of what we were seeing is such relief and surprise almost and gratitude on the part of Democrats that they were able to get something through with Republican help that I think they're hopeful that this paves the way for more in the future.
No.
And it's going to have to because they now don't have 60 votes. And unless they get a few Republicans, nothing's going to happen in the Senate. But I think in a way, the most interesting aspect of all this is Scott Brown's vote, because since he arrived in Washington, people on both sides have been watching to see what kind of a senator he's going to be. Is he going to be a Republican Party line type senator, or is he going to be somebody that the Democrats can occasionally attract? And we got to remember, the guy, you know, does have to run for re-election in Massachusetts in 2 years when the climate may be different, and I think we can expect him, like Snowe and Collins, to be somebody who periodically joins the Democrats and helps them pass things.
He was also criticized here in the Boston area for saying that there were no new jobs created in the Obama administration, and then also sending out press releases as a state senator, thankful for the jobs that were created. But just in the few seconds we have, economists say employers rarely hire based on tax breaks. So these new hires will probably be, some are saying, companies that would hire anyway. And we just have a couple seconds on that.
That's an ongoing dispute about it. And I'm not enough of an economist to know the answer. All I can tell you is some people say these things are largely ineffective. Other people disagree. This one was designed to be as effective as possible, but it's going to be hard to know the answer.
Naftali Ben-David, he covers Congress and politics for The Wall Street Journal on the jobs bill, which will go before the Senate tomorrow, Wednesday, expected to pass. Naftali, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, we want to to spend a few minutes today on the very difficult subject of child pornography. A Delaware pediatrician was charged today with the serial molestation of 103 patients. Dr. Earl Bradley of Lewis, Delaware, is accused of taking more than 13 hours of video recordings of children, and more charges against him are expected. But that story comes as judges wrestle with the question of whether people found guilty of possessing child pornography should pay restitution to the children in those images. It's becoming more common, but one victim's case in particular is drawing attention. Her name in court papers is Amy. She was 8 or 9 when her uncle took pictures of her that are among the most widely circulated child pornography images online. She's now 20. Her uncle is in prison, but Amy is pressing hundreds of cases nationwide to force the people convicted of viewing those images of her to pay her damages. In a minute, we're going to speak with Amy's lawyer, but first, with us on the line from Alexandria, Virginia, is Jonathan Shapiro. He represents Arthur Weston Staples, a former sheriff's deputy who's been ordered to pay $3.6 million in restitution to Amy. He's appealing that order, and Jonathan joins us. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. And now your client, Mr. Staples, was a part-time sheriff's deputy in Prince William County, Virginia, when he was arrested 2 years ago. It was part of an undercover internet sting. A Florida detective says he received an image of a young girl from your client and that he was promised more from your client. And then a search of your client's home computer turned up 900 child porn images, including many of Amy. Why don't you think that she should be paid for his enjoying her images?
Of course, there's no question here about the horror of child abuse and child pornography. Those are just not issues in this case.
So you're not denying that Amy was a victim of both those things?
Amy was a victim. There's no question about that. The question is, was she a victim of Arthur Staples? And is she a victim to the tune of $3.6 million? This is a guy, 65 years old, two-tour veteran of Vietnam, Bronze Star winner, no criminal past whatsoever, married his high school sweetheart. He, as is happening more and more frequently these days, got sort of sucked into the internet and child pornography on the internet. He responded to a solicitation by an undercover police officer. These events happened years after Amy was brutally victimized by her uncle. Staples, and probably thousands of others, arrive on the scene, and there's no claim that Staples ever distributed her photo. He merely had it. The judge in our case determined that he was responsible for all of Amy's damages, which would include her lost earnings to age 67 and medical treatment, including hospitalization, rehabilitation through age 80-something or other, coming to an astounding $3.6 million.
All right, well, let me jump in there, because other judges have given more nominal amounts. So let's say, what about paying $50,000? Do you think your client should pay anything?
Staples, like anyone, should pay restitution to any harm that they have caused to any victim. The issue precisely in this case is, what was the harm that he inflicted on Amy? And there's no claim that he had anything to do with her abuse.
But
he was an end user of an image of her.
Well, wouldn't that be like saying if somebody knowingly stole a product and then you knew that that was a stolen product? These are illegal images, no question. You know child pornography when you see it. It's an illegal image. So somebody stole something and then turned around and sold it to you, and you knew you bought stolen goods. I mean, when you say what's the harm, isn't that the same harm? You're sort of repeating almost the same crime. You're stealing something from someone, an image.
Right. Staples ought to be accountable for the harm he inflicted. He did not inflict that full range of harm that this poor girl suffered.
But that gets back to, you know, should there be another amount? We know that Amy finds out about your client and other men downloading her pictures because of the Crime Victims' Rights Act of 2004. That set up a system that notifies victims so that Amy's lawyer gets several notices a day when people are looking at her images. And that law also provides for a right to full and timely restitution as provided by law.
The law does indeed, and we have no argument with that. The nut of this case, though, is what is it that Arthur Staples caused? That's where we have great disagreement with what the court did here. And I should add that courts across the country have had the same problem that I've identified in Staples' case and have refused to award restitution against individuals whose sole crime was that they possessed her image years after the event.
That's Jonathan Shapiro, an attorney representing Arthur Weston Staples, who is appealing a judge's order to pay $3.5 million in restitution to Amy, as she's known, the child, now a young woman, shown in child porn that Staples possessed. Jonathan Shapiro, thanks so much for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
Well, let's bring in James Marsh, Amy's attorney. He joins us from the studios of WGCU in Fort Myers, Florida. James, we just heard from attorney Jonathan Shapiro. He understands his client did a terrible thing looking at the images. He understands Amy's a victim of her uncle who took those terrible pictures, but he does not see her being a victim of his client, Arthur Staples. Your thoughts?
Our argument is that individuals like Mr. Staples should be joint and severally liable. That basically means that Mr. Staples is responsible along with everyone else for the generalized harm he's caused my client. So he's no more or no less liable in terms of damages than any of the other defendants that are out there that are engaging in the same behavior.
And by the way, what is the damage to your client? You know, for someone who would say, geez, that was, you're 20 now. That was a long time ago. There's no identification. People wouldn't know it was you. What is the damage to your client?
Well, the real damage for her is, you know, the best way that she describes it is that whatever happened with her uncle, which was a horrible ordeal, that stopped. And if you talk to her, psychologists, if you talk to mental health professionals, there's a very prescribed treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder and things that have happened in the past. One of those treatments is to relive the event and gain mastery over it. What her damage today is that unknown individuals that she doesn't know and can never know until they are apprehended by law enforcement is engaging in activities relating to her privacy and some of the most awful and intimate things that have happened to her in her life. And the reality that we see with these defendants is that they could be anyone. They could be a sheriff like Defendant Staples was. They could be a politician. They could be the mayor. And she is identifiable in the pictures. She does look a lot like she looked when she was 8, 9, and 10 years old. And for her, the harm is having no control over this situation in which her images are distributed at will by basically a group of individuals who are operating underground and unknown to anyone.
That's James Marsh. He's the attorney for Amy. That's how a young girl is known in court papers. She's 20 years old now. And again, when she was 8 or 9 years old, her uncle took terrible pornographic pictures of her that have since been decimated on the web. She's now suing people who are convicted of being in possession of those images. We're going to take a quick break and be back with more from James. We have so many questions. Has Amy received any money? How many other victims of child pornography are taking up the new law that allows them to write to be alerted when someone is looking at their images? We'll have all of that after a quick break. Later in the program, images again. Did school officials in Pennsylvania spy on a student when they activated the webcam on his school-issued computer? Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We're talking today about how a victim of child pornography, Amy, as she's known in court papers, and now a young adult, is going to court to try to win millions of dollars in restitution from the people convicted of possessing abusive images of her. Among them is Arthur Staples of Virginia. We just heard from his attorney, Jonathan Shapiro. Amy is using the Crime Victims' Rights Act of 2004 to sue, and her case is opening the door for other child porn victims to do the same. James Marsh is Amy's attorney. Now, James, Amy wrote in court papers that it's like I'm being abused over and over again when men download these images. But if men can be found with these images, why can't these images just be removed from the internet?
That's a good question, and I know there's been some technological developments in this area, but what you need to understand is the way that these images are traded, and the defendants argue that they just had a few images and they stumbled upon them and they, you know, got a pop-up, downloaded all of these images. This is a red herring and a whitewash, because this is not how the world of child pornography operates. In order to get and receive child pornography, you have to distribute it, you have to trade it, you have to be involved in a network of other individuals who are doing the same thing. One of the most frequent ways of engaging in this activity is through peer-to-peer file sharing. Peer-to-peer networking, they're getting better in terms of being able to uncover this material. But we had a leading internet firm do a search on a peer-to-peer network of my client's images. And the company that did this survey estimated that her images are found on upwards of 40,000 individual computers in the United States alone.
Well, and to the other point that Jonathan Shapiro makes, do you have any sympathy with the amount of money? $3.5 million, that's just from one judge. And we know the amounts of restitution have been all over the board, and the judges that have addressed this, some much smaller. But $3.5 million, do you agree that is a lot?
What we are proposing and what we have made clear in our papers is $3.5 or $3.6 million is a lifetime cap for the purposes of restitution. And we believe that it's only fair that the victim receive this amount from the defendants joint and severally, which means basically that they are all responsible for paying sums to meet this amount of $3.5 million. And so the real issue is who bears the burden of pursuing that amount. Is it the defendants who bear the burden of providing that restitution, or is it up to the victim to go around to 93 different judicial districts all around the country and basically, you know, hunt down the individual amounts in all of those cases? So what it practically means is that Mr. Staples may have $1 million of assets to which to contribute to this general amount. And we will gladly provide him with the names and case numbers of all of the other defendants engaging in this activity so he can pursue contribution for those individual defendants so that he's not alone responsible for paying a disproportionate amount, but that he can seek contribution from all of the other defendants.
Well, let's remind people, the precedent for this was set about a year ago in a Connecticut court. A federal judge in a case you brought on behalf of Amy ordered a man to pay Amy about $200,000. The judge said he thought it was the first case of its kind. And immediately, people started questioning whether or not there should even be restitution. Jonathan Turley says it stretches personal accountability to the breaking point. He's, of course, the law professor. But also, other courts in Texas, an appeals court, said that prosecutors couldn't show how much harm a defendant caused. A judge in Maine said the link between possession and harm is too tenuous. So again, there's sort of this thinking, it's too subjective. How do we wrap our arms around this? What do you say to those questions about having restitution at all?
Well, what's interesting about those arguments, and my response would be that the defendant should not benefit from the fact that everyone's doing it. And if you really broke this down and you considered whether we had 10 individuals engaging in this activity, if we had 10 individuals and that was it, The beauty of that is once you've got the 10, then it's all over. Then go back to the PTSD and the treatment and the resolution and the closure can happen for the victim. What we have now is a scenario which is rather unprecedented in American legal history where we have one victim and unlimited numbers of defendants. And no individual defendant should be able to benefit from the fact that, hey, I'm one guy out of 1,000. I'm one guy out of 10,000. I'm one guy out of 50,000. And we would argue that every marginal defendant, each additional defendant, really does more harm to my client because it demonstrates that she really has no control over the situation, which will never end.
How many other victims are pursuing this kind of restitution as Amy is? Do you know?
Currently, we're aware of one other victim who is pursuing restitution. And we are somewhat aware of a third victim who's out there seeking restitution on a global basis. Certainly in individual cases, more and more victims are seeking out restitution in individual cases. But this is a very, as you mentioned, 2004 was the Crime Victims Rights Act. And as a very practical matter, most of these victims now are just becoming of legal age, 18, 19, 20. The vast majority of the victims that are involved with this crime have not sought restitution, and a majority of them are not even choosing to receive notices under the CVRA.
Well, yeah, some would say that it would be impossible for them to go through this because they'd be constantly reminded when their lawyers got these notices. And that brings us to, what about Amy? How has the success that you've had, how has that hit her? I mean, is she glad that she's doing this?
I had a conversation with her about this the other day, and without any prompting or, you know, sort of lawyerly tricks, I said, well, how are you feeling about what's happening? Is this a good thing? Is this a bad thing? And she felt very empowered by the legal system. We've had wins, we've had losses, all of these things I've discussed with her, but she feels very good about what's happening and that she's able to make a difference not only for herself but for other victims who will surely come after her and seek the same kinds of restitution.
How much money has she actually received?
Much less than people would imagine at this point. The actual amounts that we've collected to date are somewhere in the range of $170,000. We get a third. Some expenses come out of that. So she's received $80,000, probably $90,000.
James, thanks so much.
Great. Thanks for covering the issue.
James Marsh is a lawyer representing Amy, as she's known, a victim of child pornography, seeking restitution in courts. Well, we'd love to know what you think about this or any story on the program. You can always go to hearnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email, or you can scroll down and leave a comment right there on the homepage, hearnow.org. Back after the latest news, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. General Ray Odierno, the top U.S. commander in Iraq, says he's prepared contingency plans to delay the scheduled withdrawal of U.S. combat forces from Iraq if political instability and violence escalate after the March 7th elections. A series of attacks across Iraq yesterday left at least 23 people dead and raised fears that insurgents are trying to reignite sectarian warfare as Iraqis prepare for elections, elections in which the legacy of Saddam Hussein continue to cast a long shadow. The BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse reports hundreds of candidates have been barred from running for office because of alleged links to the former dictator's now outlawed Ba'ath Party.
Feelings are running very high over this issue. A crowd has gathered here in Baghdad. They're applauding to speeches being made, waving banners, chanting slogans. One of the banners here says no to the return of criminals, killers and Ba'athists to political life in Iran.
Many of these people lose their parents, brothers, sisters or sons, or daughters, and many lose their money. Many of them lost their houses, lands. I'm the same.
Yusuf Mahmoud is a doctor, and he reflects the anger of many here, some holding up large framed portraits, black and white photographs of friends and family members who lost their lives under Saddam Hussein. They simply can't contemplate the idea that people who once served one of the most repressive regimes in the world might now be allowed back into politics.
The Ba'ath Party in Iraq, we equate it to the Nazi Party in Germany.
The Shiite politician Ahmed Chalabi sits on a committee charged with purging Iraq of former members of the Ba'ath Party. Last month, he published a list of hundreds of candidates that he says should be barred from standing for parliament.
Imagine a Nazi, a member of a Nazi party, standing for elections in West Germany 7 years after the war. What would have happened? Would have anybody asked that he had committed crimes or not? He was barred because he was a member of the Nazi party.
About 100 kilometers west of Baghdad, near the town of Ramadi in Anbar province, Abu Amr is working his small farm amid a flock of sheep.
I have this piece of land, but it's dry. Look at it. There's no water for irrigation.
Abu Amr isn't his real name, and he wasn't always a farmer. For 30 years, he was a school teacher and a member of the Ba'ath Party. After the invasion, he was stripped of his job, and he now ekes out this meager living in constant fear of reprisals.
I did nothing wrong. I committed no crimes. I only worked for the benefit of others. So why did they sack me and leave me to fend for myself?
He says that if there are Ba'athists who committed crimes, they should be tried in the courts.
But why deprive the innocent majority of a living? I wish the old regime was still in place. Anything is better than this. Whatever you do, you come up against de-Ba'athification.
I do believe that was one of the biggest mistakes that happened in the country when they dissolved the Iraqi army and they dissolved the Iraqi foundations. The whole structure in the country, including the Ba'ath Party.
That's Saleh al-Mutlaq, one of the politicians who found himself on that list of candidates banned from standing in the elections in March. Although the list straddles the sectarian divide, some Sunni groups have interpreted the ban as a move by the Shiite majority to keep them from power.
They could exclude 100,000, 10,000, but they cannot exclude millions of the Iraqis. These people, they came here for revenge, for isolating the others. They cannot do reconciliation in this country.
They're tearing down one of the few remaining monuments to Ba'athism left standing in Baghdad. There are men with jackhammers atop this giant concrete and metal structure, ripping it down. The authorities can, of course, reduce concrete and steel to rubble, and they may even succeed in banning former Ba'athists from standing for office. But purging Iraq of Saddam's legacy will be a much longer and more painful process as the former dictator continues to cast his divisive shadow over these elections and beyond.
That report from the BBC's Gabriel Gatehouse in Iraq, back in 30 seconds, here and now. High school students in an affluent Philadelphia suburb are covering the webcams on their school-issued laptop computers with black electrical tape after one student claimed that the Lower Merion School District used the cameras to spy on him. School officials acknowledged that they activated the cameras 42 times to help find missing laptops, and they say the student in question had been barred from taking his loaner home. But 15-year-old Blake Robbins says he was called in and accused of drug dealing based on a picture taken in his bedroom, a picture Blake says is of him eating Mike and Ike candy in front of his laptop. The Robbins family is now suing, and the Justice Department and the FBI have taken the unusual step of investigating. Bill Bender is covering the story for the Philadelphia Daily News. Bill, did Blake Robbins even know the school could remotely activate his laptop webcam?
No, I think very few outside of district administration knew this practice was in place, and that's where the district has admitted that they really slipped up by not telling parents and students that cameras could be remotely activated while inside their homes without their knowledge.
Well, now, we spoke to the school district's spokesperson, Doug Young. He said the school isn't admitting that it took pictures of Blake Robbins, that will come out in the court processes that are ahead. But we also know the school district sent home a notice to parents and students alerting them that there was tracking software on the computers. They had to sign this. So how did that not get across to parents that it could be tracked?
I believe they did sign off on a form, but I don't think that there was any explicit notification that the laptop contained security software that would allow the cameras to start taking pictures without their notice.
Well, we also know a judge has ordered the school system to stop using the tracking software. By the way, how does it work?
Well, according to the school district, the camera on their Apple MacBook laptops with an embedded webcam that could take only still pictures when the school district believed that the laptop was stolen or if it was missing, it could be activated to take those pictures. And I believe it also captured screen grabs when it was taking pictures of whatever was in front of it. The district says that they didn't use this feature for any other purpose than to keep track of the laptops that it gives to its students.
But those computers went to all the kids in two high schools. That's 2,300 kids. And it seems there might be two issues here. One, that they were tracking the computers through those camera images, but then they, you know, called a student in, allegedly, based on what they found on one of those pictures. We know schools, you know, don't have a jurisdiction in a bedroom. Do we know what other images they captured?
Not at this point. They said that they activated this feature 42 times, but no one outside the district really knows how many actual pictures were taken and what those pictures are.
Well, again, school district spokesperson said the information that went home to parents was insufficient. They've made a mistake. They're learning from it. But how's the community responding?
Last week, everybody seemed to be pretty much outraged. A handful of people were concerned that they might end up being victimized twice, you know, once by this allegedly these pictures that were taken, and then also if they end up having to pay, you know, through their tax dollars to defend against this lawsuit. This week, you know, it seems that people are sort of starting to get a little weary of the media coverage and kind of just want to move on, I think.
Well, nonetheless, here we are covering it again. Bill Bender of the Philadelphia Daily News, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, some parents there may be tired of this story, but some others across the country just hearing about it for the first time. Let's turn to Larry Magid. He's co-director of ConnectSafely.org. He's also technology analyst for CBS News and CNET. Larry, have you ever heard of this before?
Well, first of all, it's rare that schools loan laptops to students, but no, I have not heard a school official being accused of spying on a student at home.
Several media organizations have reported that the network technician for the school district there in Pennsylvania, Mike Purbix, recorded a webcast where he talks about this tracking software. We have a little bit. Let's listen.
I've actually had some laptops we thought were stolen, which actually were still in a classroom because they were misplaced. And by the time we found out they were back, I had to turn the tracking off, and I had, you know, a good 20 snapshots of the teacher and students using the machines in the classroom.
So, you know, he's sort of sheepishly saying, yeah, I got these pictures I didn't even know I had, but they really seem to only have the intent of trying to find the laptops. Your thoughts?
Well, that certainly is their stated intent, that it be used to track stolen laptops. But again, you put tools in the hands of people, of administrators and principals and whatever, can you control everyone who has access to it? And so part of the issue may have been that they didn't have procedures in place to make sure that it was only used for that purpose.
Right. Well, besides turning on the webcam, which would mean that you could possibly see in somebody's bedroom or, you know, one hesitates to even think where these webcams could be, what else can this remote software do?
Well, it can basically track everything you're doing on the computer. It can grab screenshots. It can grab keystrokes. It can log what you're doing. It could probably, I'm certain, could tell what websites you're visiting. So it's kind of like somebody standing over your shoulder and watching what you're doing. And all of that would be something you would expect a program to do, or at least be able to do, a management program. And it wasn't just a tracking product. This product called LANREV was designed to manage remote computers. So just as a lot of employees have laptops that are issued by their companies, there very well may be a similar product, perhaps not activating the webcam, but perhaps keeping track of how you're using the machine, making sure it's secure. As long as you're using a company-owned laptop or your own laptop, if it's on the company network, they may be able to do this. So everybody should be aware of the story.
I mean, that's perfectly legal.
Oh, yeah. There's been plenty of cases where employees have gone to court and saying, my employer violated my privacy. And the judge said, wait a minute, you were using your employer's equipment. You don't have the presumption of privacy. But again, there's a difference between tracking what you're doing with the asset, with the machine, and turning on a webcam to find out what you're doing in your own home, where you do have an expectation of privacy.
Meanwhile, we understand that there's also technology available that can hack webcams. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I did quite a bit of reporting on this yesterday and talked to a number of security experts who told me about Trojans, the malicious software that can be installed in machines. I did find out of a specific piece of malware that was distributed in China that will turn on the webcam. So that's an example of an illicit product. But then there's all sorts of legal products that can be used legitimately or misused. For example, a lot of people have nanny cams or webcams at their vacation home connected to PCs that can be turned on remotely. These products are out there, and the real issue is not whether they should be there, but that they're used properly and not illegitimately.
And knowing that they are there, just your thoughts, what should anyone do if they've got a webcam and they're just a little bit concerned about, you know, wait a minute, who's possibly watching me?
The main thing, I think, is to be sure that there are procedures in place, that if your school is issuing laptops, that they have a privacy policy, that it's understood, and whether they're going to be tracking it.
Well, and as you said, it also applies if you use a laptop at work.
And you have a perfect right to go to your IT department and ask them for their privacy policies and what you can and cannot do.
Larry Magid, co-director of ConnectSafely.org. He's also a technology analyst for CBS News and CNET. Larry, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Let's set the scene. A crowded auditorium waits to hear what movie will win the Academy Award for Best Picture. Tough call, because after all, there are 10 films nominated. Who will win? Well, you just need to hear 5 words.
He's looking at you, kid.
Yes, the immortal line uttered by Humphrey Bogart as he lets Ingrid Bergman get on that plane in Casablanca, because we're talking about the ceremony in 1944, the last year until this year that 10 films were nominated for Best Picture, everything from For Whom the Bell Tolls, adapted from the Hemingway novel, to Watch on the Rhine, inspired by the Lillian Hellman play. It tells the story of a German-born engineer whose American wife, played by Bette Davis, is forced to tell her family about their undercover anti-fascist activities.
We're carrying with us $23,000. It's been collected here in Mexico from the pennies and nickels of poor people who don't like fascism and who believe in the work we do.
1944. Let's look back at that magical year with Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr. And Ty, let's start with Casablanca, because we've talked about this. People teach screenwriting weekends about this film. But was it the front runner back in 1944?
Actually, no. It was the dark horse. Its win was a complete left-field surprise. It was analogous to Crash winning out over Brokeback Mountain.
It was considered, what, a light, sort of a light romance?
No, it was considered a very good, entertaining piece of studio confectionery, but it wasn't a prestigious, important Oscar movie the way Song of Bernadette was, or Watch on the Rhine was, or some of the other nominees.
Well, let's talk about one that you mentioned, because The Song of Bernadette, which starred Jennifer Jones as Saint Bernadette, who saw visions of the Virgin Mary, that was the one everyone thought would win. Let's listen to a scene.
I saw a lady, and she was all in white.
A lady?
And she wore a blue girdle and had a golden rose on each foot. I've never seen anything in my life so beautiful.
It was the big Oscar war horse that year. It was 3 hours long. It cost $2 million to make. It was Daryl Zanuck's big entry in the Oscar race, and there was some chuckling in Hollywood that the Virgin Mary was played by his girlfriend at the time, Linda Darnell. One reason that they think that Casablanca won was that back then, Hollywood being a studio town, the extras were a sizable voting block. And because Song of Bernadette was still playing in limited release with expensive ticket prices, they found out later that only 25% of the extras had seen the movie, whereas they had all seen Casablanca and they voted for it.
Right. Well, but Casablanca has held up by any account. And yet you remind us just a little bit more about how Casablanca got made. It was sort of an accidental script.
They were writing it as it went along. In the scene where Bergman and Bogart are at the airport, Ingrid Bergman didn't know who she was going to go off with, whether it was Paul Henreid or Humphrey Bogart. They literally... pages of the script were coming in as they were filming. In the scene where Bogart's nodding at the orchestra to play Les Marseillaises, he didn't know what he was nodding at.
Well, we noticed a number of the films nominated in 44 were about the war experience. There was not just Casablanca, but Watch on the Rhine, In Which We Serve, For Whom the Bell Tolls, which, of course, refers to the Spanish Civil War, but it's evocative of war. And there was even a nominee, The More the Merrier, with sort of a comic look at war.
Well, it's a screwball comedy, but it takes place in wartime Washington where there's a housing shortage. And so Joel McRae and Gene Arthur have to bunk up with this old coot played by Charles Coburn, who's delightful and who ended up winning the Best Supporting Actor Oscar that year.
Mr. Dingle, answer me this. Who was it located and leased this apartment? Who was it made the landlord repaper and repaint it? And who was it bought furniture and drapes and made rag rugs? And who considers this apartment her home?
You.
All right, then, answer me this. Who was it allowed you to sublet half her apartment against her better judgment?
You.
Then why do you go behind my back and rent my apartment to this him?
But I only rented half of my half. Otherwise, my friend Joe here would have had to sleep in the park.
Well, what makes it even more interesting that there are so many war-related movies in 44 is that there are so few now.
True enough. One of the reasons is that you had Hollywood's output being very tightly controlled by the Office of War Information in Washington. They were vetting scripts. They were telling producers what they could and couldn't say. You had a full-on propaganda effort going on and being understood by audiences that was an important thing.
So that's what was going on in 1944. Other nominees that year, Madame Curie, the original Heaven Can Wait. Many of us are familiar with the Warren Beatty version, the modern version. The Oxbow Incident. This is the Western directed by William Wellman. It starred a very young Henry Fonda.
That's right. It was one of Daryl Zanuck's socially conscious barn burners over at Fox, along the lines of Grapes of Wrath. This was an anti-lynching Western. It's really kind of 12 Angry Men on the Prairie, where the characters have found these men they think are responsible for a murder of a rancher, and they literally sit down and debate whether they're going to lynch them or not.
It's a beautiful letter. Read it, and you'll know he's not the kind of man that could steal or kill.
Maybe. But all that kind of argument in the world can't stand up against branded cattle, no bill of sale, and a dead man's gun.
Gentlemen, I suggest we act as a unit, so there can be no question of mistaken reprisals. Mr. Davies, are you willing to abide by a majority decision?
And you'll have to watch the Oxbow incident to find out. So, Tiber, tell us about the Oscar ceremony in 1944.
It was a very interesting ceremony. It was, in a very real sense, it was the first modern ceremony. Up till then, they'd always had a banquet in a hotel banquet room. This was the first year that they decided to actually hold the ceremony in a theater, in Grauman's Chinese Theater. And producer Walter Ranger, who was producing the event, decided to include entertainment, song, and dance. It was also the first year that they really clamped down on speeches, because the previous year, when Greer Garson had won for Mrs. Miniver, she talked on for over 5 minutes, and it went past 1 a.m, and never again. Speeches had to be short.
The orchestra will start. Mm. Well, and what happened with the number of nominations? Why is that the last year that there were 10?
You know, it's not entirely clear. I've done some research on it, and I haven't really come up with a hard and fast reason. One of the reasons there had previously been so many nominations is that it was a company town. There were a lot of studios, and this was a way to sort of give every studio a horse in the race. But all of a sudden you had these ceremonies that were going on longer and longer. Like I said, the previous year went up past 1 a.m, and then you had this new event where there'd be, you know, variety acts. That was pushed. It was also the first year that was broadcast. The entire ceremony was broadcast to the public, so they had to find a way to shorten it up. And I think that's the reason that they decided they had to drop it down to 5.
Well, we mentioned Casablanca. Which other film would you pick that really stands up long after 1944?
I think Song of Bernadette has aged. I think Watch on the Rhine has aged. I think The More the Merrier is actually, because it's an unpretentious comedy. It's still quite delightful in many ways, in which we serve. Noel Coward's sort of history of the Royal Navy through the lifespan of one destroyer is still a very, very good, smart war film.
And this year, you've got Avatar, The Blind Side, District 9, An Education, The Hurt Locker, Inglourious Basterds, Precious, A Serious Man, Up and Upper, Up in the Air.
Yeah.
Of those, which do you think people will be talking about 60 years from now?
Oh, it's always anybody's guess. You look at some of the Best Picture winners, like The Greatest Show on Earth. How many people really think that's, you know, one of the greatest films of all time? Avatar, I think, is a movie that will probably look back in 10 or 15 years and say, my, how crude that is, and that the story won't hold up quite as well. You know, maybe an unpretentious movie like Up or Up in the Air will, you know, play better to audiences in 60 years than some of the more, you know, quote-unquote important movies.
Well, I'll see you then.
All right.
And we'll see. That's Boston Globe film critic Ty Burr talking about the 1944 Academy Awards. Ty, thanks as always.
Thank you.
It's still the same old story, a fight for love and glory, a case of do or die. The world will always welcome lovers as time.